Welcome to the Children's Book Author Podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor Page. If you write for children, or it's always been your dream to, you're in the right place. As the Children's Book Author, I'm on a quest to discover everything there is about writing, publishing, and marketing children's books, as well as how to supercharge my creativity, skyrocket my productivity, and absolutely everything else there is to know about how to be the best, so you can be too. Join me as I interview fabulous guests and become the children's book author. And here we go on another wonderful episode of the Children's Book Author Podcast. And today I have the wonderful pleasure of presenting my interview with Rob Kuttner. And I must first begin with a very guilty plea, because we talk about his new book, which was new, Snot Goblins and Other Tasteless Tales, was coming out in July. And this interview took place before July of last year. Yes, that's right. No good excuse. Not going to try to get out of this one, other than to say it's finally out. So go listen to it. Of course, the beauty of all of my interviews is that no matter when they're recorded or what they're about, it's truly about the timeless advice and wisdom of each of the experts, writers, people who are being interviewed. And definitely you don't miss out on anything from having gotten this podcast a little late with Rob. He shares so many gems about writing comedy and just writing in general. And I am so blessed and lucky to have gotten him on the show, because he writes for television and he's gotten, I think he won like 5 Emmys and a Grammy and all sorts of those wonderful awards because of his incredible talent. He's written for shows like Teen Titans Go, Ben 10, Angry Birds, gosh. Oh, and he's also written for Conan, which my son was very impressed with. So, I mean, you know, the minute I say, oh, I'm interviewing somebody who's written for Conan, he says, oh, finally, a good guest, because, you know, he's that age and he looks for those sort of people in the industry. So talk a lot about his book and writing graphic novels and writing funny. So a lot about the funny, how important it is to step into your childlike self as you're writing for a particular age group, which always good advice. And, you know, I forget it. I forget sometimes, because especially after writing a whole bunch of books, you sort of think, oh, I know how a child thinks. But the minute you're kind of thinking about how some other child thinks rather than stepping into yourself as a child, I think I lose a bit of that impact that I wanted to make. So coming back into yourself as that child was really great advice for me. And about being funny, being the cherry on the sundae, not actually sort of just trying to be funny for the sake of it, but setting up your characters and situations. And then, you know, the comedy kind of brings itself out. So you're going to love this interview, particularly if you want to write anything funny. I think there ought to be humor in every book, even a little. So funny, funny, funny is the theme of this interview. Do keep in mind, as I said, that The Snot Goblins and Other Tasteless Tales is already available for you to go and buy. And it's so important, A, to support other children's book authors by buying their books. I shared a picture of one of my bookshelves on Instagram the other day, filled to the brim of wonderful children's books. And of course, I can't keep them all, so I'll occasionally donate a bunch. So apart from getting them either from the library or buying them to support that author, it's also a fantastic way to learn how to write something different, or to be influenced by the way that someone else writes. And what I often do when I go to write something new, particularly if it's a new format I haven't written in before, for example, if I wanted to suddenly write a graphic novel, I would go and get some graphic novels like Snot Goblins and Other Tasteless Tales and some other ones, and I would read them and I'd pick my favorite, the one that I love the structure and the funny of and just everything about it. And then I would read it a few more times and I'd just sort of study the structure of it, how it's kind of been done. And then I'll sit down to write my own. And it often turns out like totally different, even in structure, but it's really been influenced by that particular thing. And something in my brain goes, oh yeah, I know how to do this now, even though I may not have ever done it before. And I definitely did that when I wrote, for example, Evie Everyday Witch. I think from memory, I got the one that I liked was Diary of a Fifth Grade Ninja, if I'm remembering that correctly. And I read that and thought, oh yeah, I can write something like this. And then I sat down and wrote Evie. And it turned out like totally different, but it was just getting that structure and that feel for it in my head. So whatever you want to write next, go out, get a few of those books and also support your fellow author. Not much else has been happening since the last intro I did. The last intro was hot and heavy, and this one is light and fluffy, just the way I like it. Contrasting. Contrast, one of my absolute favorite things. So enjoy today's wonderful interview with Rob. I hope that you gain so much from tuning in, and I'll see you on the next episode. Welcome back to the Children's Book Author Podcast with me, your host, Eleanor Page. And today I have a guest that's all about comedy. And look, I try to be funny, but I don't pull it off most of the time. So I'm looking forward to some fantastic tips. I'm today interviewing Rob Kuttner. I hope I said that right, Rob. You can correct me afterwards, who is an Emmy-winning TV comedy writer who is about to release his first middle grade. Now, I've got to read this because it's so beautifully written by Rob. His first middle grade horror comedy gross-out graphic novel. Don't you love that? Horror comedy gross-out graphic novel called Snot Goblins and Other Tasteless Tales. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, where do I begin with you? Okay. Let's start with the book. We'll go in that order. I never know quite where I'll begin. But let's start with the book. Why did you decide, after so many years of success writing for TV, to suddenly write a book, and for children nonetheless?
A couple of things. One of them is that I have children. So I have now a 14 and 10-year-old. So I enjoy, love reading with them and reading lots of funny books and stuff together and enjoyed all that. And so to be part of that would be, of course, it's a great experience. The big concern is that, as you know, it takes a long time to get a children's book made from start, from the idea to actually having it appear in the world. It can take years. So I had this fear that I kind of targeted it for my son, who's now 10. And, you know, so it's about 3 years ago now. And I was just hoping that it'll just get out in time where he'll still enjoy the vibe and he won't be too cool for it. Oh, dad, that sucks. Whatever. I'm going to go play Minecraft. So that was one thing. And then the specifics of how it came about was I was working on, they did a DC Comics, you know, bought Mad Magazine. You remember Mad Magazine? So, and they did sort of a reboot of it. It didn't last that long, unfortunately, but I worked together with an illustrator on that named David DeGrand. And his style is what you think of when you think of Mad Magazine, like those giant, really broad, big cartoony, a little bit of like, very silly and sophomoric, you know, but for adults. So he and I collaborated on some cartoons. And when that job ended, he was approached by people saying, do you have an idea for a kid's book? And he said, well, I work really well with this guy, Rob. So he said, I just had this idea about just doing a bunch of stories that are just about gross things, because kids love gross things. And that was really it. So, you know, thinking about what kinds of stuff I'd enjoy with my kids, what they would like, and then, you know, this guy also has two boys as well. So he's like in the thick of it. So really kind of like just trying to mine our lives for comedy.
I love this sentence, mine our lives for comedy. Is that the secret to comedy in general, mining your lives for comedy?
I mean, I think it's true for any kind of for drama and all that stuff as well. But I do think comedy can kind of come from, well, as a drama, like if you didn't actually live through that experience, it might be kind of hard to relate to it. Comedy, you can still have the same feeling about really stupid shit. Like, I'm sorry, it's a children's book, wrote really stupid crap.
No, well, it's adults that listen mostly. Right. So you're allowed to say stupid shit.
All right. I'm bringing some of that Hollywood swagger into the conversation. But I think a little bit of just like even like the tiny little stupid things that we get mad and really emotional about relate on some level to the bigger things. And sometimes we get really mad about stupid things because of the bigger stuff going on inside of that we haven't dealt with. So that's a really roundabout way of saying, I think that comedy can be found in any kind of size of moment, I think, you know, and it's just a matter of just having figure out how to like recognize it, isolate it and repurpose it, I guess.
When it came to writing this project, did you test it out on your kids? Did you actually go like, what do you think of this? And they were like, nah, not funny. Or how do you know it's funny?
You know, if I do that, it would drive me crazy because, you know, for one thing, my kid's very independent minded. Not surprising that a book author's kid would be very like imaginative. And so I don't know what his reaction is going to be like out of left field. He'll have different random reactions to things. And I can't use that as a creative North Star. You kind of have to stick to your guns. What I have to do is the same thing in a way that I was doing when I wrote for Late Night Hosts, which is to sort of imagine yourself into their voice and their world sensibility and just sort of, you know, just kind of cozy up there, get comfortable in there. And so in this case, it was like, you know, imagining life through, in this case, I guess, a 7-year-old boy, mine a little bit, and just sort of sticking that kind of perspective through a bunch of kids. And then what I would do is I would just let it, when I finished one of them, it was fully inked and colored, which again is a much longer process after. So years later, I let him read each one as it came sort of off the presses. But at that point, it was too late to give notes. So this is the one time I was going to avoid notes in my career, having been deluged with them elsewhere.
I love that approach. And what I heard in there, which spoke to me as an author, I must confess, is A, that you said that, you know, like if you kind of ask for that feedback, it can be positive, but it can also detract a little, right? Whereas it's like you put yourself into the space and then you trust that once you put yourself into the space, what comes to you is kind of like you're going to sort of somewhat stick with that. And that's different than what I've heard other people say.
Oh, really? Would other people would say that they would sort of be open to?
Yeah, like I get this kind of constant sort of deluge of you got to get feedback, you got to get feedback, you got to ask the kids, you got to get the kids. And I'm a bit more inclined to what you just said. Just on an intuitive level, it feels, but not that I won't necessarily get feedback. Mm-hmm. But for example, in one of my books, one of the characters is a witch and she brought her popcorn, her corn cob to life. And every time the corn cob gets emotional, it starts popping hot corn. And I thought this was terrific. And when I told that to my kids, they were like, I think that's a bit much. And if I had listened to that at the time, I would have taken it out, but I didn't. And Pops is one of the most popular characters in that book. So I'm kind of like, I trust the space. And I heard you say that. I've never heard any other writer so far that I've interviewed say that.
What I think is like, if you're really true about the feeling, if you feel like the feeling is authentic and you can really trust and hold on to that. So like with each of the, this has five stories and each of them comes from like what I think is a kid frustration or sort of concern that I've either observed for my kids or remember for myself. And I feel like if you're true to that and like have that be your guiding, you know, sort of compass, then anything that happens in the story, like I trust myself to come up with wacky gags. Like, to go back to the earlier point, like, is someone going to find something funny or not? All I can do is my usual approach from Late Night Comedy, we'll just throw tons of stuff at it. Tons of kinds of different kinds of jokes. Just flood the zone, as they say. And chances are they'll find something funny. If you try to, like, aim at an audience, I think, like, you can't do that because it's a moving target, especially with comedy.
Incredible advice. I'm so excited to, you know, get the opportunity to talk to someone with your level of expertise and, you know, what you just said, flood it, kind of throw a whole lot of stuff out. Is that what you do when you write for TV? Different things are funny to different people, right?
Like I said, moving target. There's so many different things to try to hit. that you might as well try a bunch of different angles. And just from day to day, like, you know, starting the TV example, we were writing for a host and, you know, their mood would change from day to day. They might be just sort of tired of a certain news story. And so they give a perfectly good joke. They don't want to hear any more jokes about it. They may have heard a joke that was similar to what you said. There's a thousand things. You kind of have to take this like Picasso approach where you're just like, I'm going to come at it from this way and this way and this way and this way and this way. They're not all going to be works of genius, but, you know, and also like this is a group project. So I'm talking about like monologue jokes, like writing for the TV shows. There was me and three or four other people. So all of us throwing in, you know, what ends up a pile of 100 to 200 for what will be 10 jokes maximum. It has to work that way. Otherwise, you have to have a lot of attempts to bite the apple to get the right one, especially in a short time frame. I mean, if you have a show that's taken a bit longer to write, you know, a scripted show, which will have a month sometimes, then there might be more time for that. But when you have a late night show, you really have to just throw a bunch of brains in at the problem all at once to have a chance of getting an answer and on time.
So working with other people and working under those conditions, does it teach you to broaden yourself almost unfiltered? Do you lose a bit your inhibitions and because you got to say these things in front of other people who might look at you and be like, that's not funny?
That's a great question. I actually had the opposite experience because I've had three jobs and my second one was working on the Jon Stewart show. And I came into it probably out of some insecurity, kind of like guns blazing, just like Mr. 1,000 jokes a minute. And I started to get word that I was annoying people because I was like overdoing it. I was trying to sort of show off my bona fide because I was feeling very insecure on people. So it was more like learning to listen. And because, you know, what's interesting is each comedy show or drama show or anything will have its own culture, like even like subculture. And you really need to sort of learn, really imbibe that culture. And it's not something you pick up right away. Like you can kind of pretend to do it, but you have to really like take time. So I think actually listening before you make jokes sometimes can be, I think if you're in this environment, you're probably not going to be too inhibited in the way that you described. I think if you'd gotten yourself to this point, you'd probably had to break through some of that natural, even though so many writers have the natural shyness, you kind of have to have broken through it, I think, to have gotten to a room.
So how did you work your way up to get into that writer's room? What are the secrets for people who want to write in that scenario?
It's not that there's a secret, there's just like a bunch of different paths.
Yeah.
Because you can't predict, you have no idea when the opportunity will come. One of them was that, first of all, that I wasn't aiming to be a late night writer exactly. I was aiming to be a sitcom or a feature writer, you know, screenplay writer. So I was trying a bunch of different things, kind of like throwing a bunch of jokes at the wall. I had an opportunity through a mate to sort of secretly send some jokes in, basically back in the time of the fax machine. So they sent, you know, back in the Jurassic era. So I could send a few jokes in as a freelancer, and if they really liked one, they might buy one. So they didn't buy any of my jokes, but I got sort of more experience at doing that, and it kind of focused my mind, and they kind of got my name in their heads. And so when there was an opening organization to be an assistant, I was hired as an assistant on that show. And a few shows let the assistants sort of be like kind of apprentices where they do administrative work for the writers and the producers and then are rewarded eventually if they have some talent with either a script, episodic narrative show, or a chance to be on the staff. So this is a show that was generous in that way. And so I was on the show for about 2 years as an assistant, you know, doing secretarial work. And I was getting better at writing the joke because I was still, they would still use your jokes. Oh, believe me, they would still use your jokes without paying you Writers Guild rates or give you permission. But I was thrilled. I was like, please exploit me. Please, I'm fully for sale here. So I was getting jokes on the show they weren't going to use. But the host noticed it. And then after a few years, they had an opening when a writer left. And he noticed I was contributing. And so he promoted me. So. And it was the very last year the show was on the air. So it's just as the train was leaving the station, I leaped on the caboose.
Wow. So you worked your way into that space. And I guess you proved yourself in small ways along the way and you built those relationships. So relationships are really important, aren't they, in the creative industry?
And that's a little hard too, is like a lot of us creatives, like it's not our first inclination. We'd rather sit at home with our laptop and our notebook or whatever, you know, rather do that than go out and talk to people. But, you know, especially specifically in entertainment. I mean, I think less so in books, even though there's certainly like networking things like Squibby and all this stuff. But you really have to be, you know, you only hear about the jobs and things from entertainment, you know, from other people. So you have to be in social circles. And sometimes that can be involved forcing yourself into that because it's not your first choice.
Right. I actually had the opposite problem. I'm a complete people person. I have to force myself into the room to write. And yet I find that it's so sort of clicky that it's hard to get in because I'm like just generally vibrant. Like this is how I am in real life, the way that I am on camera. And I'm like, hey, you go. And they all sort of turn and go, and you are?
It sounds like a version of my experience with that, with the coming in with the jokes blazing.
Exactly.
Like I come in and just do my thing. And it's like, well, that doesn't always work for people.
Because as you said, they're all introverts who are kind of out of their comfort
right.
zone.
Uncomfortable, right.
And I've got to almost tone myself down and be like, yes, yes, I am the same. But I'm not. I'm really not the same. It's really hard.
Yeah. I took an improv class with the Groundlings and it was like clear that like everyone else in the class was an actor and I was the writer because they were like, the actors were just creating these characters and just like jumping around using the space. And they were like, you're good at thinking of funny words, but you know, maybe we can expand on that a little bit.
That's a great example, actually. And how did you find that experience? Did it bring out more of that in you?
That's why I took it. I was never looking to be an improv person or an actor. I thought it would sort of like enhance my tools. And I don't know if it did or not, but I like to think that it did enhance my writing.
So let's talk about being funny. And let's, if it's okay, let me ask you, what's the difference, or is there a difference, between being funny for adults versus being funny for kids? And I'm going to go one step further than that and see if you know the answer to this. Is there a difference between being funny out loud versus being funny in writing? Is that too many questions in one? Do you know the answers?
I like that you're implying that there are answers. This is a quiz show. Well, the first one, I think that just in the same way I was saying that, like, you sort of try to dial in to a specific voice, I think there is a certain dialing in you're doing for adults and kids. And, you know, and of course, if you have kids, you practice being, not practice, but you naturally experience, like, being funny with them and, like, what they, you sort of, I don't know if it's just the way I do it because of the way I work professionally, but, like, I automatically start developing a filter, like, oh, you know, he's going to think this is funny or he's going to be amused by this again. He always laughs at this sort of thing. And it's changing too with kids. So like it's a constantly moving thing. So you might develop a filter from your own if you spend a lot of time with kids. In terms of the broad strokes, I mean, I think that it's not incredibly surprising, but I think like kids tend to respond to things that are more general absurdities, universal experiences, things happening in the moment, especially I think reversal of expectation. The high being brought low, that sort of thing in a very simple way. And, you know, to some extent, those are still the engine that I think of adult comedy as well. But I think adult tends to sometimes, for good or for ill, go into sort of like referentiality or just sort of playing in different vibes, like playing different kind of moods and stuff, like having different cultural connotations for adults who've been through, seen a lot of stuff. You know, so there's a lot of different like flavors and textures that will be brought into the adult version of stuff. And then I think there's like an extra layer of, you know, it depends on the adults. Like, you know, my wife and I are so dark. My comedy writer friends are just super dark with each other. But, you know, some of those things might not fly with other adults as well. And then your second question was about written versus audio. I mean, so, one thing I noticed, this would come up sometimes with, like, I like a good pun. So I noticed, like, especially in monologue jokes, that, like, a good pun sometimes will just not translate orally. That sort of thing. Like, it has to be one, like, if you see it, or vice versa, it only works orally because if you hear it, that sort of thing. That's how I would get thinking about that. And in terms of just like sketching out how it would work, I feel like the difference would be about sort of to make it really boring and academic. Like, I think auditory processing, basically, like, if it's on paper, there's a little bit more leeway to be a bit more complex, I think, because your eyes can kind of skim back or they're sort of taking a while to hang on to it versus audio. Like, you got to catch it all and there's no going back. And this is like, in fact, you know, Conan O'Brien, that was part of his style, was he would kind of like circle back sometimes to kind of like the key point or like the key fact or word, even in just a 2-sentence monologue joke. You think of monologue jokes as being very like, very short and concise. You'd sort of make sure to circle back into it so that like, just to make sure the audience like had all the information in their head. And that was like very deliberate style. Not everybody like followed that style.
How would you describe your style when you wrote Snot Goblins and Other Tasteless Tales? Give us a feel. What's the style of funny that's going on in that book?
I think my style is that it's, to go back to the kid point of view, it's sort of kids getting to really like really embrace something, some really big feeling or some desire that they're often not really allowed to, not allowed to feel. And like what happens when it goes up against the world, So in the first one, it's like the universal desire of not to go to school. Like what if a magical creature came out of your nose and told you you could avoid school, but at a terrible cost, you know, so taking those ideas. Or there's one about, you know, blended families, about this girl whose family is going through a divorce, but it's like her father's marrying a mummy. So it's like, not only is she like the mom from hell, she's a pharaoh. She's literally has a pharaoh complex and she has to discuss. So it's like taking, as I said, like these real feelings and then just taking some level of absurdity and exaggeration to them. And also like, you know, in this case, whenever possible, introducing something disgusting into it. I'm also very nerdy. So like the mummy stuff, I started researching ancient Egypt, and this is based on a real pharaohiness. This woman, Hatshepsut, who was an overlooked female leader, who was like a great pharaoh, but the male leaders after her erased her legacy because of sexism and jealousy. So she's kind of been hidden a bit. So she has this like axe to grind. And then I started researching like what ancient Egyptians use for like toothpaste and what do they eat? And it's like all these things that, you know, are gross to us because they involve fermentation, right? Like fish innards and stuff. Like, even though if you think about it, we do eat things like, what is cheese really? Cheese is like rotten cow mucus, right? You know, it cut up in blocks. So these things look gross. So I was like, oh, so what if like, you know, in this family, like the kid is, look at my Egyptian toothpaste and it's ox hooves and ashes and stuff like that, which are real things. So I got to bring in real things that are also gross. And so to me, that's like winning the lottery, is like being horrible and also being factual in a very nerdy fashion as well. But also coming out of the overall vibe of it is like, oh, having a new family, a stepmother and stepbrother and stuff is horrible for a kid. Like it's disgusting. It's overwhelming. You feel like we're in control. So that's like, she's a pharaoh taking over the, I'm sorry to get like really pedantic here, but I'm saying like the kid part is to try to match a feeling. The humor is to try to match a feeling to a really over the top scenario, I guess, if that answers your question.
It really does. That's actually really genius. I love that you're taking, like you said, this everyday difficult situation that brings up big feelings and then almost expresses that, like the child can cope with that feeling through the humor, which is, I'm sure it's probably somewhat similar to, I guess, when we watch comedy for adults even, isn't it? Like, you know, now I see a lot of comedy around COVID and things and we can all laugh. You know, it's that Woody Allen line of tragedy plus time equals comedy. It's almost like in the child, it's in the minute though. They don't need that time after. They're kind of like saying, hey, if you look at this situation and can make it funny, your book has this higher aim, but it's doing it through this incredibly fun thing. And then I love that you say you bring in some fun facts that are actually facts, but again, they're almost time bound. Made sense back then, but to us, right. That's so gross.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, it's genius. Very, very clever. So did you sit down and kind of like write it all at once, or did it take like a period of time? What's your style of pouring that out?
It took a little time. This one sort of proceeded in iterations because I was working with an artist and we were kind of taking the stories one at a time, piece by piece. So we sold the proposal. And then we agreed on like the five stories. And then we just sort of had really kind of just a log line in mind for what them on. We kind of put them all to bed, just waiting as we approached each one individually. So we get through each one. And then I would go off and like basically just do sort of a detailed outline. And I had this fantastic editor who was just really great with story and really good instincts. And he would give me notes on that. And then I would like revamp that into a better outline and then just write the script. And then send that off and get a set of notes. And then the artist would begin working on it, like doing some roughs of that while I was getting notes. So finally, when I had like a script that the editor agreed on, it was finalized for the artist, he's off to work on that. Then I'm off cracking the next one. Like I have to start over the, you know, with the outline again. So it was just sort of like, you know, like sending boats out, the waves bring them back, you know, you hit them, they come back again, that sort of thing.
Yeah, great, great. And so you're very much a plotter, like you plot things out. You don't what they call go by the seat of your pants, or is it a combination? But you have a very tight outline by the sounds.
I know there's a big debate about that. I feel like with a prose novel, I feel like there's, at least this is just my comfort level with it. I feel like a prose novel, sure, just anchors away. Let's just float out into the ocean of words and see where it lands us. Anywhere is a good place to go. I think that with graphic novels, specifically for me at least, it feels like it demands a bit of structure, just in terms of like how the pages are laid out. And also, I think because these were kids' stories, I felt like they had to be pretty nice and tight. But all that said, I wasn't really, you know, it sounds like I'm very plotty, but like my process is also very like right brain. Like the way I come up with a plot is like, I sit down with these things, these like really, really barren nubbets. I'll give you an example. So the second story, this is a funny story that I think I'm going to be telling on all the podcasts now. The second story was David sort of pitched the ideas of a couple of these stories, and Snot Goblins was just his idea. That was the whole idea, just Snot Goblins. What would that be? Goblin kids' noses. And so then I came up with matching it to my kids' experience, wanting to get out of school. The second story was, he called it just the Wampire, like in Wham. And his whole idea, this is all his idea, was it's a vampire who's squeamish about biting people, so he hits him with a mallet instead on the head. And he knocks him out. And that's the whole idea. So I sat down with that, even though I have a very, like, you know, that story, if you read it, is very complicated plotted. It goes through decades and centuries of time, and like all these things happen. And in fact, I had to work in like how to like insert all these parts of early 20th century history, like Thomas Edison and the Titanic. And like, I had to sort of figure out how to do that. But the idea was like, I just started thinking like broadly, what would it be like to be a vampire who wants to do things differently from his family? Maybe they don't accept you. Maybe they think you're a freak. What if you want to leave home? And then I thought, maybe to get at your earlier question about I think it's funny. It's like, if you remember the movie, This is Spinal Tap, there's a very fine line between what's stupid and clever. Like, to me, to find that razor edge is like the ideal. So to me, I was like, this idea is so stupid. It's a vampire hits people with a mallet. But what if I could just go so epic with this and make it like this story about the immigrant experience to the United States, about like the old world and the new world, about different ways of being a vampire. So once I introduced the idea of like, the silly idea of like, what if I made it historic? So I could have just done that. He's a vampire. His family doesn't accept him. He goes off to a thing and meets new friends. The end. Instead, when I made it historic and epic, and it suggested all these things to me, like it said, oh, well, then what if he learns from Thomas Edison how to refrigerate blood to keep it? You know, all these things started, like the history started like lining up, and then it started taking on a structural form. So that's a long way of saying also that like, once I opened my brain to the really crazy part of it, then I shut it back down, or at least cool it down enough to put the building blocks in. So I don't foreclose on that part at all. That's later in the process for me, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, because it's actually the combination of the two that really makes it the level of epic that you're describing.
Right,
in fact, if it missed one or the other, it would have lacked something. So maybe at the highest level, we should stop debating pantsers or plotters and kind of really just be a combination of both and make peace with that and move along.
Maybe. Works for me.
You know, I hear you say, you know, such and such said this. And so even like there's still that collaboration sort of process happening between, you know, you and the artist and the editor and the, which is, again, it's like you are brilliant, but with those other little things, the brilliance expands.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. Yeah, the art and the editing have brought so much more to this than like in so many levels.
What's the plan once it releases? Are you then traveling the countryside and doing school visits? Where does it? How are you approaching it as an author?
The book tour is a thing of the past.
Okay.
What I am doing is I'm going to my hometown of Atlanta, and I'm doing a blitz of 3 bookstore events in one day. It's going to go over the weekend if it comes out. I'm going to try to be a bit creative with it. So one of them, it's a bookstore that's affiliated with a coffee shop, so they're going to make some disgusting treats to go with it. Rice Krispie treats. So like, we're going to have Rice Krispie treats with little poppy seeds. You know, it's a little, not actually gross, but gross things that kids will like, you know, or snot green jello. So I'll just do that. And then I don't know if I'm going to have an event here in LA or not. I haven't quite nailed that down, but I am trying to get into some schools. I'm partnering up with someone who does slime parties to see if they want to do like a Snot Goblins party where we use some of the characters from the books to do games and activities and stuff like that. Yeah, so I'm trying to learn, and then just doing podcasts. Oh, I am doing one at a bookstore, a couple of bookstores, where we're going to have a couple of them participate, and you can go and collect a card of one of the characters in the books if you go to all the stores. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. It'll be fun.
Was Macmillan a good publishing house? It was your first one to work with, yeah. Was that a good experience? How was that? I mean, I know you're not allowed to say anything bad about your publisher. Not that I'm suggesting you do, but, you know, how did it feel as a first-time author working?
From an editorial point of view, they were great. They've been great all along. In terms of, like, the publishing and the marketing part, I mean, I'm just experiencing that now. So we'll see. ask me in a year.
authors sometimes think that the publisher's going to go and do all the marketing, but authors have to be half of that partnership. So yeah.
I actually had another book come out. It wasn't for kids a couple of years ago. And I learned the hard way that it's like they don't do the publicity. So that's why I'm doing all this. But I also have I made a bunch of promotional videos, some animated videos and some comedy videos that I've made that I've released, some of which the illustrator and I had a contest where we had people's kids send in their most disgusting thing. And then he's made an illustration of these for the 30 days leading to the launch. So we put one of them up on social media every day. We call it the Gross Down.
What a great idea. Yeah, we'll have links to all those so you could go and have a look, dear listener, and see how it was done. That's really clever, really clever. It is always, that little bit harder, isn't it, when your audience is kids, because they're a little bit harder to access in the sense, yes, they might be on social media, but they're probably on TikTok or something. I don't know. My kids are.
This is a question we've had. We've had this discussion because I think they're not on TikTok, really. Our target group is elementary, so 6 to 10. They're just shy of TikTok and they're not on Roblox. And Roblox, you can't really do that. And then at the same time, they're not definitely not on the adult ones. So we determined that YouTube was if anything, stupid billing, so.
Yeah, because where do you find them? That's right. And that's why a lot of the times we access them through the schools and the bookstores and things like that. And is the aim to write more children's books? Do you think you'll do more?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was really accessing my inner child, as they say, I think, and from a very me place. And then, so David and I have another proposal out that's not the same thing, but it kind of a similar kind of vein. And we'll see where that goes. And, if people like this, then my son has been pitching me ideas for the next one. So
I love it. He's getting involved.
Yeah. Yeah. He wants a cut. He wants a piece.
My son always comes up and says, "So, Mom, when are you actually going to write something that's genuinely funny?" I'm trying. I'm working on it. He's like, no, it has to be. But he's got an out there sense of humor, really out there. So he'd love, a book like yours. That's the key, isn't it? It depends who you're, like you said, who you're pitching it at. Oh, no, it's got to be like you said, at that razor edge. Even beyond the edge, he'd love it.
It's going to be the kids like me, basically.
As your parting words, give me, I'm an author. Rob, how can I be funnier when I write? This is what I want to know.
This is going to sound counterintuitive, but save the funny for last. A lot of people make the mistake. I'm going to go in, front load this. This is me at the Daily Show. I'm going to front load this with funny sounding words and puns and jokes. And it usually comes across as just adornments that don't really stand up. So get the characters real, get things really, really tight, make sure lots of energy is there. And if you have a funny brain, I think the comedy will come out of it. You can't force it. It has to come out of the situation with the characters.
Right. So the comedy comes out of the situation with the characters. So it can come out from the characters themselves interacting. When you watch something on Hollywood and the characters are some of them are butting heads and that's actually funny, the way that they're
interacting. That's the point. That's by design.
Or the situation itself lends itself to creating some funny in it.
Or both. Or two people reacting to a situation completely differently and then fighting over it. But just people saying funny lines isn't really inherently funny. It doesn't get you very far or it stands out. The moment has to have some reality, some kind of reality to it. And then the comedy just takes it to the next level of look how ridiculous this is.
I've read a few books where I know it's my last question, but I have a tendency to do this. sorry, Rob. I've read, some books where the writer expects it to be funny because someone farted and that's it. Yeah. And I'm like, dude, that's not funny. Do you know what I mean? Everybody, right. It's got to be something about the fart, right? What it does.
Yeah. It's the cherry, not the sundae. That's you got to do this, right? The ice cream and the whipped cream first.
So just to take that comedy to the next level, it has to be how that interacts, how everything interacts with that.
It has to be
something
absurd or exaggerated or surprising already built into the situation. And then the comedy is just this sort of drawing attention, almost shining a light on that as opposed to just trying to be wacky, 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 wacky.
Yeah. And as you said, set up your good characters and that energy and then save that comedy for last. I love this. Thank you so much, Rob. Good luck with launch of the new middle grade book. It's going to be great.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I had a great time talking to you.
Thank you so much. All the links to Rob and the book will be in the show notes. Go check it out. It does sound really funny. And if you want to be a funnier writer, study that book. Buy it. Study. That's what I do. Buy it. Study the book.
Buy two copies. You'll be twice as funny.
Buy two copies of Ego, twice as funny, one on your left, one on your right, and then you can you can be a plotter and a pantser.
Exactly.
Work out how to do it yourself, because the best way to learn is to learn from the great people before us, such as Rob. So thank you so much, Rob, for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
Did you find that interview valuable? Great. Now be an awesome human and go and leave a review, because it helps the podcast out so much. Want to read the show notes? Check out thechildrensbookauthorpodcast.com. Want to find out more about me, Eleanor Page? Find me at eleanorpage.com, or come and say hello on social at Eleanor Page Books. Until next time, keep writing and keep learning.